I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Coming up, the life of a rural letter carrier. Writer Casey Sepp tells us about her mother's job delivering mail to her more than 500 customers. We'll also talk about threats to destroy the U.S. Postal Service and some ideas about how to reinvent the agency. President Trump has had a long-time beef with the Postal Service. Here he is back in April in the Oval Office saying he would prevent the agency from receiving a $10 billion loan unless it raised the rates for shipping packages from Amazon and other large delivery companies.
The Postal Service is a joke because they're handing out packages for Amazon and other internet companies, and every time they bring a package, they lose money on it. So Amazon and other internet companies and delivery companies are dropping all of their, not all of them, but a big portion of packages and whatever else they're doing into a post office. And the post office is supposed to deliver the packages, and they lose a lot of money. The post office, if they raise the price of a package by approximately 4 times, it'd be a whole new ball game.
While the president may not be a fan of the Postal Service, most Americans are. In fact, it enjoys something like 90% approval rating. The USPS has a new postmaster, Louis DeJoy, who begins his job in June. Joining us is Jacob Bogage, who's been covering the Postal Service for The Washington Post. We should say that Jeff Bezos, who owns Amazon, also owns The Washington Post. Jacob Bogage, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Pleasure to be with you.
So is Trump's beef with the post office with the post office itself or with your boss, Jeff Bezos?
I don't want to try to get inside the president's head on that. But I've had a number of independent experts who study the Postal Service and mail issues say this has nothing to do with the Postal Service and the way the Postal Service operates or even charges for packages and mail. We heard the president at the beginning of the segment talk about how the Postal Service was a joke. Almost none of what he said in that in the Oval Office that day was true. The Postal Service does not lose money on deliveries for Amazon and internet companies. It doesn't lose between $2 and $5 per delivery. The Postal Service, it's not like the Postal Service is flummoxed every time Amazon shows up with a bunch of packages. They know the packages are generally coming. Almost nothing the president says on this topic is rooted in the truth.
I appreciate you saying that because it's always important to correct misinformation like that. But nonetheless, at least that was a couple of weeks ago, it seems that the administration, maybe the Treasury Department, maybe the president himself, wants the post office, the Postal Service, to raise rates for packages. Can they do that?
That's an interesting question. Strictly speaking, no, they can't do that. Package rates are controlled by what's called the Postal Regulatory Commission. They look at competition. They look at the price of living and inflation. And they set rates on packages and postage and stamps and stuff like that. However, the Postal Service's Board of Governors controls that agency, and the President and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin have been trying to leverage influence either through coercive borrowing or through political appointments to try to gain more influence with the Postal Service and thus be able to influence what it could charge for packages.
I'm thinking, I don't know what it costs to pay for a package, let's say, to get delivered from me to you down there in Washington, D.C., but if you charge 4 times that amount, the consumer's going to end up paying a lot more.
The consumer's going to end up paying a lot more. That's exactly right. Every analyst of any stripe I talk to on with any sort of ideological lean, if they have them, says the way this would work is companies like FedEx or UPS or Amazon or DHL or whomever would pass this cost on to the consumer. This is basically a package tax.
a package tax. It's interesting you say that because there is a consortium of companies like Amazon, eBay, I think QVC, CVS Health, and they call themselves the Package Coalition. They've been running some ads. You've written about this on Fox, critical of what they call the 400% package tax. So they are fighting back.
Yeah, they are. And there's a really interesting public relations and lobbying battle going on behind the scenes between FedEx and UPS, which have a bit of a closer relationship to the president and the White House, and Amazon and some of these other internet retailers who don't have that same kind of more familiar relationship with the White House, trying to get in the president and his policymakers' ears and let them know not necessarily what this would do to consumers, but what this would do to their business, what this would do to the Postal Service. And I think the people who get lost in this are the small businesses all over this country who rely on the Postal Service for safe, reliable, and cost-effective shipping. You know, the small businesses, the flower shops, the Etsy stores that send stuff all over this country. But, you know, they don't have their own distribution network. They don't have Prime. They don't have, you know, the shipping specials that FedEx or UPS might have. They need the Postal Service. A 400% rate increase on them would be truly catastrophic. Mm.
Also, in the, you know, in the middle of this pandemic that is essentially, you know, brought down so much of our economy, I mean, it seems like a strange time to be talking about raising rates on packages.
It does and it doesn't. This stems from a larger conversation about the Postal Service's finances, and I know you're going to get into that with Casey a bit later, and she had really had a fantastic piece in The New Yorker a couple weeks ago. But the Postal Service says, look, we're going to run out of money in October if you guys can't fund us. So what does that mean? That means service disruption. So maybe not 6 days a week of mail. Maybe that drops. It means they're going to miss payroll in that case. The Postal Service employs 630,000 employees across the country. That's the largest public sector workforce outside of the Department of Defense and the military. It's an absolute behemoth, and it is so – I had one source compare it to your sewage system. You know, you don't realize something's wrong until it's really wrong, and then you want it fixed immediately.
That's a vivid way to think of the Postal Service. What about – I mean, these are union jobs. Is the union safe under these conditions? And I do want to talk about the new Postmaster General, but is this also about unions, fighting unions?
Yeah, this is absolutely about fighting unions. The White House has made very clear through its policies, through the policies of its cabinet officers, that it does not see protecting unions, protecting collective bargaining as a priority, a policy priority. And the postal unions, there are four big ones, and they're kind of the last bastion of the strong public sector unions that we're all used to kind of, we all have this image of in our heads. Collective bargaining reform on the Postal Service kind of would be the death blow to public sector unions as we currently conceive them.
Let's talk about, his name is Louis DeJoy. I think I'm pronouncing his name correctly, and he's been tapped to become the new Postmaster General. Jacob, tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, he's an interesting guy. He ran a couple national logistics companies. And so what that means is you have one client who has a big piece of cargo or has, you know, something they have to ship, and you've got to find them someone who can move it for them. So you're kind of brokering that relationship. So there was one company that employed about 10,000 people. He took it. It was a family business when he took over. It was 10 people. He grew it to about 10,000. Then it was sold, and he sat on the board of a larger company called XPO Logistics, which got into trucking and actually moving some stuff itself. And that was, you know, 100,000 employees all over the world. And that's a really interesting company as well. So you have some people who say, gosh, this guy has a background in the areas that are going to help the Postal Service become a lot more cost effective. And then you have other folks saying this is an act of political patronage. Louis DeJoy is very close with President Trump. He threw President Trump a birthday party in 2016. He hosted a fundraiser at his home in North Carolina for him in 2017. He's the finance chair for the Republican National Convention taking place in Charlotte. He's raised more than $2 million for President Trump and Republican causes since 2016. He's very, very involved. His wife, Aldona Wass, was a former ambassador to Estonia under President George W. Bush, and she's Trump's nominee for ambassador to Canada. Wow. So this is a very politically involved family, and there's been criticism in the past about them using their money to create political connections. But he also, there's a lot of people who say this guy is very qualified and brings a lot of experience in places where the Postal Service hasn't had someone with this kind of expertise.
And didn't work his way up through the Postal Service, obviously an outsider coming in.
Correct. Yeah, he'll be the fifth Postmaster General who has not had any postal experience. Compare that to the outgoing Postmaster General, Megan Brennan, who was once a letter carrier and rose her way up through the system that way.
We have a Facebook question, actually, from Jason, who says, "Will Trump intervene with the USPS in an effort to quash mail in voting?" Of course, this would be in November. But just to piggyback off of that, I mean, if the U.S. Postal Service is running out of money without some kind of efforts to save it or make it more solvent, what would happen in the fall if it had no money?
That's a great question, and that's a question I get constantly. It's a scary proposition to think about, but you also have to remember the sheer size and force of the U.S. Postal Service. It's 630,000 employees. Postal workers are actually part of this country's disaster relief strategy. Think about if there had to be a vaccine that had to be delivered door to door. The Postal Service, literally Department of Defense documents, is the one who's supposed to go do that. So it's going to take a lot to bring down the U.S. Postal Service. And you have to think also about how Congress works. They like to work on a deadline, right? And so we've got between now and November for them to get some sort of funding. They already have this $10 billion on the table they can tap into if they really accept the terms the President and the Treasury Secretary are putting down. So they do have the wherewithal to make it through this. But you also have to look at whether the president and the people he installs or encourages the Board of Governors to install to run the Postal Service, if they'll prioritize vote by mail.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times, getting our conversation started. Jacob Bogage, thanks for joining us.
Oh, good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And he's been covering the Postal Service for The Washington Post. And we do have Casey Sepp waiting in the wings. She's going to join us, talk a bit about her mother's job as a rural letter carrier, some of the threats to the Postal Service, and how to rethink or perhaps even reinvent the service coming up. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. The founders of this country believe that having a postal service was so vital to the functioning of this young democracy that they wrote it into the Constitution. Article 1, Section 8 says that Congress shall have the power to establish post offices and post roads. Philly's own Benjamin Franklin was, of course, the first postmaster general. Our guest, Casey Sepp, wrote about her mother's job as a rural letter carrier in a recent edition of The New Yorker in a piece titled, "We Can't Afford to Lose the Postal Service." She writes about her mother's 50-mile route, her close bond with her customers, the history of the agency, including threats to the Postal Service starting back during the Bush II administration. In fact, even before coronavirus, the USPS was losing money because of competition and the internet. Casey Sepp is a staff writer at The New Yorker and joins us on Radio Times. And thanks for joining us, Casey. Nice to have you with us on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, to join our conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. We are talking about the history of the Postal Service and Casey's mother's experience with the service, but we also want to talk about how to possibly reinvent the agency, and we are interested in your ideas about that. Casey, let's start with your mother. She's been a postal worker, a letter carrier for something like 40 years.
Yeah, 38 years. And I think, you know, that's a notable enough number for any profession. But what's especially interesting to me is 27 of those years have been on the same route, so the same 50 miles every day. And, you know, we think about this when we talk about teachers in a public school or, you know, a minister at a church, but my mother interacts with the same, you know, 500 people 5 or 6 days of the week and has for every week of the last 27 years. And it's just a remarkably textured relationship. And I've always admired it, and I've always admired how hard my mother has worked. And, you know, I couldn't help but mention her when I got asked to write about the post office. And originally this piece was just about coronavirus and whether she had gloves and masks and, you know, the precautions the agency was taking. But of course, you guys have been talking about this on the show. There's a bigger story and a more precarious one at this moment for the post office and what will happen and what it might be. But for me, when I think of the agency, I always think of my mother and the work she's done.
Well, you know, you write about her, and I appreciated that. I mean, she seems like a wonderful letter carrier. I mean, someone who cares deeply about her customers. She knows them. She has helped them. And it's so interesting because I think that letter carriers, they know about us because they're on our front porch, or they're, you know, putting things into our mailbox or through the front door. They see the kind of mail we get. They have a sense of who we are. It's so interesting.
Sure. I mean, I think there's a kind of a emotional version of that. And look, a lot of novelists and short story writers have made hay of it. You know, the postmaster knows everything and the mail carrier knows your innermost secrets. But I talk about this in the piece. And I think when we start to talk about what the post office could be, you know, there's also a really straightforward structural consequence of that, which is the reason so many people love the post office is it is the part of the government they have the most regular interaction with.
Yeah.
And so every day of the week, you know, more than 600,000 employees interact with Americans all across this country in 30,000 offices. And there's just tremendous penetration, and it personalizes the government. So, you know, instead of the kind of bogeyman where your taxes go and you don't see what benefit you get, you see people like my mother every day, and I hope that everyone listening has had the kind of experience her customers have of someone who wants to meet their needs, who wants to help their business thrive, who's reliable and available to them. And so, you know, there's this kind of, for me, romantic version of my mom and, you know, what a nice person she is and how hard she works. But I'm mindful, too, that it's just a tremendous opportunity to reach Americans. And we've seen this year with the census. You know, we can get a hard copy census to everyone to make sure they're counted. We saw this at the beginning of coronavirus. You know, we could distribute CDC guidelines. And I know that, you know, the internet and email and digital communication and telephone lines are part of this conversation. But, you know, to have a living, breathing postal worker who visits basically every resident in this country is tremendously important for the government. And it would allow us to respond quickly. And, you know, there was a period of planning for the Postal Service where they were originally going to be one of the distributors of vaccines or life-saving, you know, contents. And you think, well, that's so silly. Why wouldn't it be the National Guard or something like that? And, of course, the Guard has to be mobilized. And here's this civilian force that really does already have the distribution routes and the knowledge to fulfill them. So, you know, I think there's a kind of quotidian version, and that's the one I talk about with my mom's career. But there's also just a more kind of structural and essential one.
what you, writing about your mom got me. I've lived in the same house for 40 years, so probably as long as your mom has been delivering mail. It's a small town outside of Philadelphia, and have gotten to, I know the name of my postal, of the guy who delivers letters, or the women that have delivered letters over the years. So, the way you wrote about her got me just thinking about it. I know these people to some degree.
Oh, yeah.
My dog probably knows them better than I do.
Sure. Very sweet for me. I published my first book last year, and I actually think if statistically you could analyze where the most copies were sold, it would be on those 50 miles of my mom's mail route. And, she was delivering copies. And, of course, for some of those people, they remembered me, in elementary school. And, when they get their New Yorker, every week, they always look at the table of contents to see if I'm in it. So, the relationship goes both ways. And I'm very grateful for the career she's had. And I do think it is part of this conversation about what we want the agency to be and the kind of jobs we want it to provide. Because, you could privatize it and you could turn these jobs into gig jobs just the way that, Uber works. But you would lose that reliability and the service would suffer. And I tell a story at the end of the piece of my mom checking on one of her elderly customers who had fallen. And it's a woman who lived alone. And, you had to know that she lived alone. You had to know that she reliably got her mail. And that knowledge is why, day two of her not coming to the door, my mom went in to check on her and found that she had fallen and that she was compromised. My mom was able to notify out-of-town family members. So, these are really deep and meaningful relationships.
Let me add one more thing, and then I do want to talk. The history is always interesting, and obviously there are challenges and threats to the Postal Service that we do need to talk about as well. But these are union jobs, and as you write, your mom was able to, and your family was able to have a stable and secure income and enjoy, I guess, the benefits of a really solidly middle-class life.
Yeah, I mean, these are the jobs we talk about when we talk about the American dream. My mother graduated from high school. She didn't go to college. She didn't have a college degree, and yet she had a job that was reliable and trustworthy and had a union that fought for incremental wage increases and benefits. And we had health insurance, and she has a pension. The reason my mother can retire after 38 years is it is the kind of job everyone hopes for. You pay your dues and you get to retire. And I really worry. I mean, that is privatization would not only hurt customers, but we are talking about 600,000, pathways to the middle class. And I think there's a particular vulnerability with the post office. It has this really wonderful history since the 1970s of fair and equitable hiring. And I was so touched. A lot of people have written stories like mine, and one of them is the actor Danny Glover. And he wrote about, the particular way that postal jobs were available to minorities and to veterans. And, those pathways are more and more precarious, and there are fewer and fewer of them. And, I think one of the things we've learned with the gig economy is not all jobs are created equal. And if you privatize these, and if you take away their benefits, and if you make them into lesser part-time menial jobs, it will be much harder for the people who have them to get by. And they'll need more government services, or they'll need additional appointments. So I think that is one of the pieces, and it explains why, even though the post office is the most popular government agency, why it is so often targeted for cuts and curtailments and disruptions to the services it provides. I think it's real animosity to labor.
Well, and I want to pick up on that. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Casey Sepp, and she's a staff writer at The New Yorker. We saw her piece just a couple of weeks ago in The New York. It was titled Why We Can't Afford to Lose the Postal Service. It's both a personal piece about her mother as a rural letter carrier, some of the history, some of the threats to the agency, and also some ideas about how to reimagine the Postal Service going forward. And again, you can join our conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org. That's our email address. You can always tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Well, let's talk about what happened in the aughts. And as you say, coming into the 21st century, the Postal Service actually was running a profit. It was a profitable agency. But then during the Bush administration, there were some changes that Congress put into effect, one of them having to do with raising the rates, tying it to the Consumer Price Index. But even more onerous than that was mandating that the post office pre-fund its pension retirement costs for the next 75 years. That is just, who thought of that? Where did that come from?
Yeah,
and has that ever been asked of any other agency?
Exactly. Of course not. You know, no other public or private company is forced to operate this way. It's a wonderful thing to pre-fund retirement accounts. Sure. Let me be clear, you know, that's not the poison pill. The poison pill is saying you don't need to do it for the next year or the next 5 years, but the next 75. So to your point, you know, 2006, when this law was passed, that year the post office had a $900 million profit. It was incredible. You know, it was a profitable agency. And I think one thing just to clarify for listeners is the post office does not take federal money. It doesn't operate with tax dollars. It operates entirely self-sufficiently based on the services it provides. So when we say in 2006 it made $900 million, that was, you know, through stamps, through priority mail, through, you know, post office boxes, P.O. boxes, that sort of thing. Right now, you know, the post office is asking for federal assistance, but it hasn't had any since 1982. And that law was designed, you know, when you say who came up with it, you know, I really think this is an example of, you know, an actuary in some dark, dark room of some dark, dark basement literally thought of a way to cripple the agency.
Wow.
And it is that bill that instantly, you know, instantly cut into the revenue of the Postal Service. And so they've been running, you know, that's about $5 billion in retirement funding that every year, that's the deficit we see. You know, right. It's so funny when people say the Internet killed the Postal Service. Of course, on a topic, but again, 2006 is many, many years after the Internet had taken hold and many, many years after businesses had migrated some of their business online. You know, 2006 is very much the digital age, and the post office was still profitable. So it's a lot of what we're looking at in terms of the deficit it's carrying is from those pre-funded retirement requirements. And in fact, you mentioned, too, the cost of services is restricted, so they're very easy legislative fixes.
Well, and you even write, I mean, just going back to this pre-funding of pension and retirement for the next 75 years, it means pre-funding for people that haven't even been born yet.
Yeah, these are general funds, so it's not like they're like, you know, anticipating the birth of, you know, Mr. Joe Postman from Bozeman, Montana. But yeah, you know, 75 years, you know, people who have been hired will be drawing the benefits they're forced to fund. So it's coupling. It really was a requirement designed to make it look unprofitable to justify the argument for privatization.
Casey, we're losing you a little bit on your phone. I don't know if you're moving around or not, but if you can just stay put, that would be good. I just want to make sure our listeners hear what you have to say. And we're going to probably call you back after the break. That's about 5 minutes. Let me just read a couple of comments here. One from Susan. It should be a departmental agency funded and regulated by the U.S. government, like the military, education, agriculture, commerce. I mean, it is an independent agency, and I don't want to get deep into the sort of nitty-gritty details of that, but it's sort of curious that way.
Yeah, that's a great point from a listener. So it was until 1970 a departmental agency. So they're right to hearken back to that, and it changed status under President Nixon. So that is one of the most radical proposals would be to really just tuck it back under the federal government to divorce revenue from the actual profits it makes. I don't think we need to go that far. I think that listener is right to elevate the essential services it provides and that we should maintain the universal mandate, which is what you would get from having it be a department agency. Mm-hmm. But I think we can keep that. And a lot of the postal reformers and a lot of the commentary from the unions says, you know, we don't need to go that far. But again, as recently as 2006, it was profitable. It was doing what we needed it to do, and it was doing it universally across the country. But certainly, if we look back at history, that is one of the features the founders had intended. You know, it was part of the government, and the federal government not only funded it, but made sure it was functioning properly. But again, not everybody thinks we need to go back quite that far to have it operate the way we need it to.
Well, I think anyone today, I certainly noticed, you know, the mail that comes through my mail slot is, you know, it's just a mere shadow of its former self, though it's clearly losing money on first-class mail and other mail that postal carriers deliver. But it does deliver packages, and I don't know if that's profitable or if that's helping to mitigate some of the challenges to the Postal Service because of coronavirus.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, to be clear, the Post Office does need help right now. It does need a federal boost, and a lot of other, you know, a lot of other private industries have gotten them. You know, the comparison I like to make is the airlines have already gotten $50 billion, and half of the people in this country will not take a commercial flight this year. You know, they wouldn't under the best of conditions, and they're not going to do it this year, and yet obviously Congress saw fit to support the airline industry. And the mail affects us all, and the mail is essential for so many rural communities, so it makes sense to give it some assistance this year during the crisis. But you're absolutely right. Under normal conditions, package delivery has made up for the decline in first-class mail. And with some modest tweaks around pricing and service provision, you know, again, the post office could be profitable.
Right. Here's a comment from Elise. Can the post office save money by not running mail deliveries on Saturday? I mean, is that an option? I know that's been bandied about a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, you've got these intelligent listeners who have basically done the work of some of these postal reform committees, which have charged millions of dollars and taken many bucks to come up with these ideas.
Right.
Yes, absolutely. You know, one of the, we want to maintain universal delivery, but we want to be smart about how we provide it. So absolutely, one of the proposals has been just the way that on Sundays you sometimes get your packages, but you don't get first-class mail. One of the proposals is to do that with Saturdays and possibly other days of the week. So you would continue to operate a package fleet, and you would continue to deliver, you know, certified mail, priority mail, overnight mail, but you wouldn't do bulk mail or standard first class. You know, that would go to 4 or 5 days a week. And that is one of the proposals that even advocates of the Postal Service are open to, because it reflects the changing reality of mail volume.
We're almost having a break here, but and we'll pick up after the break. But the idea of turning the post office back into a community bank, which actually was in the early part of the 20th century. Just quickly, if you don't mind, Casey, and then we'll take that short break.
Yeah, absolutely. This is one of my favorite proposals, because I think it's, you know, you asked me about the history earlier, and it sounds like you're a history nut like I am. And I love when things are so easily forgotten, especially good ideas. And from 1911 to 1967, the Postal Service operated community banking, and it was tremendously successful. Millions of Americans used it. It actually held about 10% of the funds in this country. You know, you could go into any post office and make a modest savings deposit, and, you know, provided bank accounts for people who couldn't afford them otherwise. And right now, that's true of about a quarter of this country. There are people who can't afford, you know, a low-fee bank account with a normal bank, and they rely on payday lenders or loan sharks for their banking services.
Sure.
So letting the post office do this is, I think, one of the most straightforward things we could do to make it profitable and to make it even more useful to the American public.
And that's Casey Sepp. Again, she's a staff writer for The New Yorker. We're talking about her piece titled, We Can't Afford to Lose the Postal Service. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And we're talking about the U.S. Postal Service, one of the most popular, perhaps the most popular government agencies, enjoys something like 90% of public support. It is under attack, under threat. And our guest, Casey Sepp, wrote about both the history and some of these threats to the Postal Service and the future of the service as well, some ideas there, and the fact that her mother spent almost 40 years as a rural letter carrier. The piece was in The New Yorker, and it is titled, We Can't Afford to Lose the Postal Service. And you can join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Interested in your ideas about how to reinvent the Postal Service. Casey, let me go back. I am a bit of a nerd when it comes to history, so let's go back to some of the early history of the Postal Service. And obviously, from the perspective of the founders, they saw this as really central to a democracy, the idea that we could correspond with each other. It's probably tied to, you know, how people would be able to get the news in this young democracy. Help us understand the thinking of the founders back then.
Sure. You're absolutely right. It had a lot to do with communication, you know, in this large, already geographically diverse country. But even more essentially, you know, we're talking about the summer of 1775, the Second Continental Congress. That's when Ben Franklin was named Postmaster General and the agency kind of came together. And even more importantly than what the new nation would do, it was essential to breaking away from the old nation. You know, these were colonists who at that time depended on the Royal Mail. And they needed a reliable way to communicate, you know, discreetly, safely across long distances. You know, they were planning a revolution. And so it is built into the Articles of Confederation. And you've already said this, but it's written into the first article of the Constitution. And I think that, you know, one of your listeners who said, look, it ought to be a government agency is really aware of what the founders sense, which is that, you know, these freedoms and the ability to stay in touch and the ability for the government to reach into every community under its authority was essential. And I love, you know, for history nerds, you know, when you go back and look at this stuff, you can read all the founders talking about the mail and what they want for it and, you know, wanting newspapers to be able to thrive, so giving them a discounted rate. And, you know, all the way through the years of this country, you just see the post office kind of tracking its expansion and its development. And it's really a beautiful thing. And, you know, I mentioned this in the piece, but I do have this very kind of civic-minded notion about the Postal Service and how essential it is that it be available to every American and that it operate equitably. And when I think of what the founders said about newspapers, I'm mindful today, you know, we need there to be a democratic mail, just the way there's a democratic press. You can imagine the private company that gets pressured to, you know, stop delivering the New Yorker because, you know, the president didn't like the article that was in it. You know, these political attacks go very deep, or, you know, the sudden decision that certain kinds of businesses would be charged more than others. It's a very dangerous idea, and I think the founders were right about what we need the mail to do.
Let me just touch on a couple of really interesting little moments. So the postage stamp is invented in the 19th century. The mail slot required in front doors, that's part of the early 20th century. And that was, of course, because of the Postal Service. And you also write about the fact that, and again, this is the 20th century, a couple that used the mail to send their child, I think, to a relative.
Yeah, there's actually, you know, for listeners who want to go deep on this, there are a bunch of these stories. And I love them because it just shows, you know, again, people trust the mail. They know their carrier. They know how reliable the service is. And so there's a little bit of a novelty trend when parcel post first started, which was this discounted shipping rate. And so, yes, you know, you had people mailing their infants to their grandparents or, you know, their toddlers to their cousins a few towns over, and it was cheaper than a train ticket and, you know, well worth the price. But I think the slightly more serious demonstration of that level of trust is I was shocked to find, you know, I was looking for an example of, you know, really high-profile mailing, and it turns out Harry Winston mailed the Hope Diamond to the Smithsonian when he donated it. And he spent $2 on the postage. Now, he did buy insurance, but again, you know, this is a service a lot of countries would die for. You know, it really is there for everyone and at an affordable and reliable rate. So history is just full of these great stories. It was a pleasure to get to think about them.
Let me read some more emails. One from Zachary says, why would a Republican president be openly opposed to an organization of 600,000 blue-collar workers? And then he asks, aren't they the people he claims to represent? I mean, do you see this as an attack on union workers?
I think it is, whether or not you come out and say that directly, of course it is. You know, when we talk about, you know, why would someone write a law so pernicious and so designed to cripple this agency? Absolutely. You know, I don't think President Trump would ever come out and say that. He does personalize this fight to some extent with a conversation about Amazon and the Washington Post. But I think at the heart of this privatization scheme is really just that. You know, this asset, you know, these post offices, these mail routes, these delivery routes, they are profitable to some extent, but not entirely. And when you privatize them, you can stop sending mail to rural communities, which are costly. You can eliminate the kind of union jobs that cost money to sustain and offer gig jobs. And I think that's absolutely what it is. And we should be plain and forthright about what the consequences of this action will be. It might save a little bit of money in the short term, but it will cost this country tremendously in the long term.
Here's a comment from Steve. He says the USPS has a, quote, last mile agreement with a lot of carriers, and I think that's really harming the agency. The idea, I guess, like your mother in a way, you know, what it's the Postal Service that is responsible for all these rural routes.
Yeah, that's a great point. So just to clarify that last mile language, it basically means some of the packages you mail, even with FedEx or with UPS, these private courier services, then get handed off to the post office for certain addresses. And I think that, you know, your listener is right to question the profitability of those arrangements. To some extent, the post office recoups those costs. You know, they have their own profit sharing margins with UPS and FedEx, and they charge them. It's not as if they're doing it for free. So I think that's an example of the Postal Service needs to be able to be nimble and set their own prices and make their own arrangements for deliveries like that. They're not inherently unprofitable. You know, again, that's why UPS and FedEx charge so much more money to customers for any given delivery. You know, for the most part, the Postal Service's prices are discounted comparatively. But that goes back to that 2006 law and letting the Postal Service set their own prices so that they can be profitable. I don't think that's an inherently bad arrangement. You know, it might always make sense for the Postal Service to be the one sending mules down the Grand Canyon to a Native American reservation there. And that doesn't mean FedEx can't take advantage of their services, but we've got to let the Postal Service charge the amount of money it needs to and not have a board of governors setting the price rates.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, when you think of a stamp and whether, you know, I'm mailing a letter down the street to a neighbor or to someone living in Alaska, I'm going to pay that. Obviously, a stamp costs the same no matter where you send it within the United States. But if it were privatized, do you think we would end up paying different rates for sending out first class mail?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think there's a universe in which FedEx is delivering a postcard to Honolulu to you for, you know, under $5.
Right.
You know, there really is. And this is why I think the people who are so supportive of the agency, they see what would be lost. You know, it really would just change the kinds of services we're able to provide, and it would punish certain kinds of communities. So I think there's a straight, I don't think the mail will end. You know, there's a kind of bogeyman of, well, we won't have post. Of course we will. It will just be tremendously expensive and prohibitively so for some small businesses and some rural communities.
Here's an email from Naomi for helping raise money, and this picks up on something you said earlier. Why not reinstitute the postal banking system? Not only could it be run to help the unbanked, which you referenced in the modern era, but could also issue credit cards and make a few percent on every purchase. And again, this goes back to something that the Postal Service used to do. But as you said, there are people that are unbanked in this country in that they go and they pay an exorbitant amounts of money in order to be able to put their money somewhere or take it out somewhere.
Yeah, thanks so much to the listener who brought this up again, because I think, you know, it can't be advocated for enough. And for folks who are listening who are interested and passionate about this, there are some groups who have organized around this, and there are certain members of Congress, like Senator Gillibrand, who's really leading on trying to get postal banking through. So the post office couldn't just decide to do it. It would need congressional approval, and it's Congress who killed, you know, postal banking in 1966, and it went out in 1967. So we would have to change the law to let them do it, but absolutely, I think this is a wonderful, it's a no-brainer. You know, it would charge very low fees, and it would open up opportunities to a lot of low-income Americans, which, you know, that unbanking figure wavers anywhere from 15 to 25% of this country.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's veterans whose VA benefits they have to pay exorbitant fees to cash the checks for. You know, that is people on Social Security or disability who don't have a checking account, so they pay a money order fee every time they pay a bill. You know, we could really meet the needs of a lot of low-income Americans with postal banking. So I would love to see it happen. And I think that, you know, there's an interest and there's an appetite for it, and folks who are interested should certainly start writing to their members of Congress about it.
You also talk about notary publics at post offices, or maybe using post offices where people can go vote. I mean, there are buildings in just about every community in this country.
Yeah, I think it's a time to think creatively. You know, again, right, there are 30,000 post offices around this country, and, you know, members of Congress love to rename them, but they should start thinking about what else we could be doing in them. And what else these carriers, you know, again, rural letter carriers like my mom, city carriers like some of her colleagues, go door to door in this country every single day. And, you know, there are some radical proposals, like they could be, you know, administering broadband internet, They could be selling hunting and fishing licenses. They could be, you know, dealing with your license or your, you know, car tag renewals. There are a lot of ways they could be doing federal or state services in a way that's more convenient for more Americans. So I just think, you know, it's a really great moment to think about what can we let the post office do? Instead of thinking about, you know, how to kill it and privatize it and reduce the services it provides, it's a great moment to think about, look, this is an agency 91% of this country loves, regardless of party. You know, Republicans and Democrats love it just the same. So let's let it do more.
Yeah, it's, I mean, we shouldn't think of the post office in some kind of partisan way. That just doesn't make any sense. Here's Dave. He says, I get Amazon deliveries on Sundays delivered by post office employees in postal trucks. Does this make or cost the USPS money?
So it makes them money. You know, when we talked about how the kind of mail volume had changed, it's certainly true the internet reduced the amount of first class and bulk mail, but it just surged the amount of package delivery. And Amazon is one of the partners the post office delivers for on Sundays, but they pay the same amount anyone else would for those packages to be delivered. So that's one of the things, you know, the listener earlier who said, well, what if we stop delivering on Saturdays? Even if we were to stop kind of normal, you know, open your mailbox and there's a, you know, set of advertisements in it, we would still want to have that package delivery because that is the volume, that is the profitable part of the most profitable part of the post office's business. And it shouldn't be available just to Amazon. You know, it's anybody who has priority or certified mail deliveries. You know, we want that to be happening 7 days a week. And that's a really nimble service that the post office could provide and could continue to make money on.
Here's an email from Andrew. Most mail we receive now is spam and unsolicited mail. It seems that this sort of public nuisance mail should not be taxpayers subsidized and should pay a rate that supports the Postal Service, not the other way around. What do you think of that?
Well, to be clear, you know, the government is not subsidizing that mail, not since 1982. And I think that's one of the most pernicious misunderstandings of the post office is that somehow, quote, taxpayers have been paying for it all along. If the post office were to receive right now, there's a proposal, they've been offered a $10 billion loan from the government, and some Democrats in Congress have proposed a $25 billion grant. It has not received anything yet. So I think that's one really important point of clarification. The mail you are receiving is paid for by the people who send it. You know, the businesses who want to solicit your business or, you know, whatever bulk mailers you're getting. The government is not subsidizing those. And I think it's a straightforward question of even if the post office were to receive a $10 billion loan or a $25 billion stimulus grant, you know, you could choose to think of it as subsidizing bulk mail, or you could choose to think of it as subsidizing the post offices in rural Alaska, you know, or you could think of it as supporting 600,000 blue collar jobs. You know, how we think about the support the agency might get is another question. But just to be clear, all the mail you're receiving is because businesses have decided it's profitable to try and reach you at your home. So, you know, unsolicited or not, you know, you're not obliged to have a mailbox. So if it turns you off, you can, you know, turn it off. But I think right now a lot of businesses, you know, in the digital era still take advantage of those bulk rate mailings because it's a chance to reach customers at their home. It's why politicians use it. You know, direct mail is just a way of soliciting people's attention. But, the businesses or the entities who take advantage of that are not being subsidized by taxpayer dollars. They're paying for it.
We're almost out of time here, and obviously it's a critical time for the U.S. Postal Service. Do you see, and actually our first guest said, you know, the way Congress works is everything is kind of at the last minute, but they need money and they need it now. Do you think that's going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, they absolutely do. Mail volume's down a third. It's supposed to be down by half this summer. And right now there's a $10 billion loan floated by Republicans, but Secretary Mnuchin has tried to place a lot of restrictions on it and tried to use it in a really partisan way to extract agreement from the post office instead of just giving it the way Congress has suggested it should be loaned out. Speaker Pelosi put forward a bill yesterday that's got $25 billion in much less restricted funds. So I think it could happen, and I think it should be part of the next stimulus bill that's passed. And again, this is a moment where if you love this agency and your business depends on it, or if you just cherish the mail, it's the time to make your voice heard. You know, again, the airlines got $50 billion, and half of this country will never take a flight this year. So when we think about, you know, what we want our tax dollars to do in this stimulus moment, it's the time to let our members of Congress know our priorities and what we value as a country. And I think, you know, if surveys are right, the post office is one of those places, and it's just a matter of communicating our priorities to Congress.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Casey Sepp, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Marty. Have a great day.
You too. And she's a staff writer for The New Yorker. Her article in The New Yorker, titled We Can't Afford to Lose the Postal Service, she wrote a book last year called Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.